time now for Connecting the Diocese. Connecting the Diocese is a production of the Diocese of La Crosse. Here's host Jack Socha.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in, Connecting the Diocese from the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin, right on the banks of the Mississippi River. Got Tom Thibodeau coming up. He is a distinguished professor of servant leadership, always has something to make you feel better about your world as you listen to him. But first, speaking of something kind of neat, congratulations going out to Sister Andre in France, who is now the world's oldest living sister. And also, by the way, the world's oldest living person. Born in 1904, she's 118 years old. Still in pretty darn good condition for someone who's 118, still mentally fit. She does attribute her longevity to a daily glass of wine and chocolate. We'll be right back with Tom Thibodeau, right here on Connecting the Diocese. Well, you may have heard that Dr. Fauci has announced that the pandemic is officially over. What does that mean? Does it mean the virus is gone? No, it does not, by no means. It simply means that we do not have the vast numbers of people getting infected, the hundreds of thousands of people that were getting infected a year ago. The numbers have dropped considerably. Sadly, there are still up to 500 people a day dying of COVID-19. So it is not gone by any means. And sadly, the majority of those who are dying are unvaccinated because it hits the unvaccinated much harder than those who are vaccinated or boosted. You also may have been reading that more and more people who are high-profile politicians have been getting infected. Our vice president just got infected. Why does this happen? It's not because they're Democrats or Republicans or whatever the case may be. It's they get to see a gigantic number of people in any given week. And the more people that you are in contact with, the greater chance there is that somebody will not have gotten vaccinated or it will be a breakthrough infection and they will infect you. That's the bottom line. So what does this mean to you? This means that especially if you are vulnerable, and most certainly if you are still one of those who is unvaccinated, you should be careful in crowds. The more people you come in contact with, the more times you're in a large unventilated area with a whole bunch of people, the greater the chance is that the virus, which is still lurking around, might get into your system. If you see people wearing masks, they're not making a political statement. They're either being extra careful or maybe they've got some immune problems and they're being really, really careful. In my case, I tend to shop on Wednesdays because it's not as busy as opposed to a Friday night or a Saturday. Simple things like that can make a big difference because, again, the pandemic, the numbers of people getting sick are much, much, much lower. The number of people dying are still significant, but not as many as before. But it's still out there. So take precautions. Be careful. Watch out for crowds and watch out for close, unventilated areas. Stay safe. Well, as promised, Tom Thibodeau, distinguished professor of servant leadership at Viterbo University, is back with us. We're using our new technology. You are in your house. I'm sitting in my home studio, and we're staring at each other, but it's still good to see you.
It's always good to see you, Jack, and good to be in your presence and talking with our friends throughout the diocese.
It has been an interesting few weeks. I was so pleased at Easter. For the first time in 2 years, we got to travel to Madison to see relatives and to see them face to face and talk to them and notice things and just have conversation back and forth where we could see each other. It was just delightful to do it. And hopefully things will stay better. But right now it comes and goes and we managed to slip in. We even tested ourselves with those little test kits that we got. Yeah. I discovered something that my wife, if you put a little probe up her nose, begins to sneeze like crazy. So it's kind of nice we're doing it in the privacy of our own home because she would have been terribly embarrassed otherwise. But we were negative and we're still negative. So I think everybody was vaccinated or at least didn't have it. So that was good. That was good. How was your Easter?
It was very good. It was holy and solemn. And mm-hmm. I'd like to begin with this. On Holy Thursday, we have the great ritual of washing of feet. I worked in a parish for a number of years, and one of the most difficult things to do was to get people to have their feet washed. We're embarrassed by our feet. It's awkward. And then you realize that it was meant to be awkward. Service is oftentimes awkward. doing things that we are uncomfortable in doing is awkward. Those feet that Jesus washed were terribly dirty, walking through mud-filled and blood-filled streets during the Passover. It was a very difficult task, a very humbling task, and he took it on. And at the end of washing feet, he said, "You realize what I have done? If I, your teacher and Lord, have washed your feet, you too are to wash each other's feet." And you begin to recognize that in that very humble act, he taught us what it is to serve one another. If service is beneath us, leadership is beyond us. And so that great act is service. And then it's followed by the breaking of the bread, the sharing of the cup, Jesus promising, "I will always be with you." And so that act of service and that gift of self gives us hope. And then after the Mass, where the altar is stripped clean and there's this bareness, it's just these bare essentials of just the altar and silence on the congregation. And as Father Conrad Turganski processed with the Eucharist around the church, he said aloud, "Odessa, Kharkiv, Mariupol, Lviv, Kiev, Bucha, all these towns in Ukraine, where people are really spending time in the agony in the garden, wondering when they will be attacked, wondering, will they survive? Will they have the strength?" And in that moment, you understand we were truly in communion with our brothers and sisters around the world. The gift of the Eucharist is the gift of self, of love, of hope. And then Good Friday, we reenact once again the suffering of God. And when people walk up and touch the cross, they bow their heads and oftentimes weep and sometimes kiss the cross. The absence of God in that moment is profound, it's silent, it's sincere. And how many times do you think that people throughout the world, as we watch innocent people dying, where is our God? Where is our God? Elie Wiesel, the great Jewish author who wrote the book Night, talks about the night in which a number of Jewish prisoners, maybe four, escaped. And the Germans brought them out at the concentration camp at Auschwitz and said, "Who escaped and who helped them? Tell us or we're going to hang one of you." And nobody said anything. And so they grabbed the man out and they brought him up the gallows and they hung him. "Tell us who escaped and who helped them." Nobody said anything. And they took a second man and they hung him. And they said, "Who escaped and who helped them?" And they grabbed a 12-year-old boy and they hung him, but his weight wasn't strong enough to break his neck and he struggled in the gallows. And they marched all the prisoners past the struggling boy dying. And somebody yelled out in the crowd, "Where is our God? Where is our God? Where is our God?" And a voice in the night said, "Tonight he swings in the gallows. Tonight, our God again is being crucified and attacked." But that's not the end of the story. And then there's Easter. And the great gift of Easter after the resurrection, they're afraid, the doors are locked, and Jesus walks into their midst. And what does he say? "Peace be with you. My peace I give you." The gift of the resurrection is the peace of Christ. The gift of the resurrection is the peace of Christ. Can we risk our lives and our faith on that? And last week, what did we witness? The people of Ukraine gathered in their churches, Eastern Orthodox rite of Easter, lighting candles. They are singing alleluias, believing in the power of the risen Christ to bring peace. Yes, I believe in diplomats. Yes, I believe that there has to be military intervention in order to save poor, innocent people. But are we not praying that the peace of Christ reign in the hearts of our leaders? Jack, you and I grew up in the Cold War. We remember the 1950s. We remember having to go through nuclear war air raid attacks, hiding under our desks, or if people were in a park, having to go underneath a picnic table, or people in New York City having to go down into the subways if that could protect us. But also what we did at that time, under the instruction of Pope Pius XII, after Mass, we dropped to our knees and said three Hail Marys for the conversion of Mother Russia. And many people who are listening today will remember those times from their childhood when, under the threat of nuclear attack, we prayed and prayed for the protection of our Blessed Mother. Extraordinary. Pope John Paul II gets elected. He had to also flee the Nazis so they would not conscript him. He was a worker. He went underground when he studied in theater and then theology. And yet he finds himself as a pope, the leader of the Catholic Church, and returns to Poland, in which 2 million people show up and the Russian tanks were mute. The power of the Eucharist and people of faith brought down the Iron Curtain. It wasn't a political solution. And could we believe that those prayers for decades for the conversion of Russia, do you think that God's hand was a factor in that? Can we stake our lives on this kind of fate, or are we going to just only believe in political leaders and warfare? Peace I bring you, my peace I give to you. Jesus says to us early on, blessed are the peacemakers, not the peace lovers, not the people who enjoy peace, but those people who work for peace each and every day. Jack, you just cited the wonderful people working in the city of Milwaukee, finding medicines, finding food and clothing, anything that refugee people will need in order to survive. Blessed are the peacemakers. Those of us who are Catholic, can we not look to pride with pride to our brothers and sisters in Poland who are literally opening up their homes and taking in women and children? Women and children who have left behind fathers and brothers and husbands in order to protect their country, and they have no place to go. And the Polish people and the Romanian people say, come, stay with us. Dorothy Day said, every home should have a Christ room, a room in our house that is empty so that when Christ arrives, Christ has a place to stay. I find great hope in that kind of courage and generosity. People showing up at the borders with hot cocoa and strollers for mothers who have walked for days hoping to find a peaceful place to rest their head. So this is an extraordinary time. Can we look at it through the eyes of faith? I think we can. I think we can join our prayer with our charity. I think we can join with the prophets in crying out for justice. Speaking with Pope Paul VI, who spoke to the UN in 1974, when he said, war no more. We are called to be peacemakers. Isn't extraordinary? One of the most radical documents written by Pope John the 23rd was Pacem in Terrace, peace on earth. In the midst of the Cold War, he wrote to the leaders of the world, imploring them to embrace peace on earth, not only for ourselves, but for the next generations. This is a time in which our prayer is needed more than ever. Our faith can be strengthened. We are not to lose hope, because we believe in the resurrection. Now, that's a little bit of a theological treatise. It's not divorced from real life or real politics or the projection of evil. The only thing that allows evil to triumph over good is for enough good people to do nothing. And we are people of faith. We can do something. Jack, you've done this faithfully for years, interviewing people, asking people to speak a word of hope, recognizing goodness, rather than speaking of despair and depression. I think this is our task.
The funny thing was, last week I was having on Chris Rogers, who is the director of young adult ministry. Now it's called director of family life. And he was former youth director at the Diocese of La Crosse. Because I had not spoken to him for at least 18 months or longer, well, all his adventure camps and all these things that he normally would do were on hold because of COVID. And because of that, I didn't really have much to talk to him about. So finally, I got hold of him. And in the conversation, about 18 minutes into the show, he mentions that a year or so ago, he had a stroke and he could not speak and he could not read and he was scared to death. And I almost fell off the chair. I said, wait a minute, forget the adventure camp. What are you talking about here? You know, turns out that he was hospitalized. And you know how this whole thing works, because you had the same thing in your family. But he said he was in his hospital bed, and he said he swears that the evil one said to him, "Your life is over. Your service is over. You're not going to be any good to anybody anymore." And then he thought, he says, "No, that's not God talking to me." And he said, "I will be fine. I will be better." And I said, if the worst came to the worst, if I could not talk again and could not read again, he said, Jesus would still be with me. The next morning, he wakes up on the hospital bed, and he looks at some of the signs that are on the walls. And he says, "I'm going to read these things." And he begins to make out the words, and finally he can read. And then he begins to talk. He goes, it gets his cell phone out and reads every email message he has until he can start speaking again. Doctors came in and were very surprised. They said, you had a close call. You had a warning, because you've got to do better things with your health. He says, but there's a part of your brain that died, but there's another part of your brain that fixed it. And he's back. I was amazed, because he's talking with me like he always does. And he just went through a personal hell. And he was at first despairing and angry at God. And then he said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And, he didn't call it a miracle, nothing like that. But what a situation. And I'm sure you're familiar with the whole process with people who are trying to recover from strokes. But to be sitting there saying, "I can't talk and I can't read. And what do I do for a living?" Amazing. And I've never had that kind of experience, thank goodness. But it was just the idea that his faith in God, even though he was lying there in that bed, unable to communicate or read, he said, "God's still with me." Just, again, one of those remarkable, we took a half an hour to talk about this. We stopped talking about everything else that we're going to talk about, because this was more important. And it was as comforting a thing as when I had talked to Bishop Callahan after he had his bypass surgery, and he confessed that he was scared that he could die, but he had faith in God. So it's amazing the stuff that goes on around you. That there's people who have experienced things that walking on the streets, you wouldn't even know. You wouldn't know about it. And there's people experiencing things in Ukraine that I'll never fully understand how they get through it. And the people who are inflicting this, I'll never understand what's going on. With these conscripts who thought they were going in to do a parade or something, and next thing they know, they're being told to start shelling buildings. That it's really hard. We don't know. We know that not every single person is walking in lockstep in that entire country saying that we should be doing what we're doing. And there's people quietly trying to protest, even though even if you call it a war, they will throw you in jail. And yet they're still doing it. It's just remarkable, the strength of the people in Ukraine and the strength of some of the people, many of the people in Russia, to stand up and say, "No, this is what you're telling us on the TV is just not what's going on." Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinary time.
It is an extraordinary time, and you find the Holy Father speaking out on behalf of all those who suffer. The Pope speaks on behalf of people who have no voice, and understand that there's same kind of war that's going on in Eritrea. For many years, people in Yemen now are suffering from starvation. I mean, there's all kinds of collateral in this. Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. Ukraine is responsible for 12% of the world's calories. Think about that. 12% of the world's calories of grains that go to places like Yemen, that go to places like southern Sudan, places where they're suffering from drought and migration, people not having enough to eat. It was the people of Ukraine that were feeding them in their rich farm fields. You see farmers in Ukraine putting on flak jackets, getting on tractors, planting their fields to feed their people. Courage is grace under pressure, was said from Hemingway. And we watch this and we see this grace under pressure. Ordinary citizens doing what they can to protect fellow citizens. Ordinary citizens coming out and finding the bodies, dead bodies of their neighbors, and making sure that they have a grave and a ritual and people to pray for them and to mourn for them. I mean, this is faith in action. And so instead of looking away, and I've talked to people who say to me, "Well, I don't have to worry about that. That's not anywhere near the United States." Well, what's the parable of the Good Samaritan? Jesus said, "Who is your neighbor? Who is your neighbor?" Well, right now our neighbor is an Ukrainian family fleeing for their lives. Who is our neighbor? It's those people who suffer, like you said, the conscript who from Russia, who's 18 years of age, away from home, has no idea where they are or what they're doing. Who is our neighbor? Those people who are suffering from starvation and hunger. What is it we can do? We can't do everything, but we can do something. A number of years ago, when I was working at a homeless shelter, the Day House in Omaha, Nebraska, I came across an amazing artist, Bill Farmer, and he works with stone and brass. And I bought a sculpture from him, and it's a crucifix, a brass coming out of a rock. And on the cross, Jesus is in a hammock, and the nails are at the bottom of the cross. And the name of the piece is called apathy, that Jesus is crucified today by indifference. We must pay attention. We must pray. We must sacrifice. We must do what we can, for blessed are the peacemakers. The peacemakers. We are all called to this by our baptism. Peace I give you, my peace I leave with you, is the gift of the resurrection.
You know, it's often said that in warfare, the first thing that you do to your opponent is you dehumanize them. You come up with some phrase for them that's very, very downgrading, and you try to make them into something that they are not, that they're not people. You're not really fighting these people. These are just whatever the word could be. And we did it in World War II. They did it to us, of course. It goes on back and forth in Vietnam. But some of these people who are suddenly going into Ukraine, and told to start shooting are some of these people we're told were like deserting, basically. They were disabling their equipment. They were doing all kinds of things. The Ukrainian army suddenly found that they had more tanks than they had before the battles, because some of the Russians were just saying, here, I'm out of here. That's important. It's really easy to just say, every single Russian is bad. We should nuke Moscow. And here's Jesus saying, you got to love your enemies. Now, I don't know how many people are praying for Vladimir Putin to have a change of heart. Maybe they think it's futile, maybe they don't, but it's part of what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to try to pray for a change of heart of these people on an individual basis as well as collectively. And there's just like there's great people in Ukraine doing great stuff. It's extremely hard, but there are some people, I'm sure, behind the scenes who are trying to divert whatever is going on from this. I think Belarus, which is supposedly an ally of Russia, they were sabotaging the rail lines. They were breaking up the railway ties so the tracks were no good to keep war materials from getting from Russia through Belarus and into Ukraine. There's people doing stuff like that. And it's very interesting to see what's happening. But again, we can't harden our hearts for everybody too.
Think about the Irish. The Irish were very anxious to invite people into Ireland, refugees. Why? Because they had lived under persecution. They knew what it was like to live under oppression. Please come and stay with us. I saw a man get in his Volkswagen and drive from Germany to the border of Poland and Ukraine, looking for a family that needed a place to live. Come and stay with me and my family. These individual acts of hospitality, radical hospitality, welcoming the stranger, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, taking care of those who are sick, this is our call. Of course, our gas prices are higher. Of course, our food prices are higher. We are living at a time in which abundance is being challenged. What sacrifices are we willing to make for peace? This is our challenge. This is what God is asking of us today. Think about our grandparents who stood in line during the 1930s for a pound of flour and a pound of sugar. All the food then that was produced after 1940, plowed to the fence for civil defense. The food went to our soldiers fighting Nazi Germany. And so it was people in our rural areas that then brought food into the cities to feed their fellow citizens. We have it within us to sacrifice on behalf of one another rather than attacking each other. Can we come together? A peacemaker has the challenge of bringing people from different perspectives together for the greater good. That is the work of the gospel. That is the good news of Jesus. Challenging to be sure, but it's what we're called to do.
At the end of World War II, the United States not only assisted in the rebuilding of our European allies, but they also assisted very much so with the Marshall Plan in the rebuilding of Germany and also in Japan that were quite destroyed as well, with the idea that you can't just get reparations from the vanquished. It doesn't work that way. It worked. I mean, we now have friends and allies that were once terrible enemies, at least for a good period of time. So we're going to have to really sit down and just not listen to these people who are just saying, we can never forget. You know, we will never be friends with these people who did this to us. This is really hard to do. It's, whether you do it on an individual basis or whether you do it on a, you know, as a country, time passes. And, you know, now we have all kinds of products and materials made in countries like Japan and Germany and elsewhere. Heck, I've got a camera made in Vietnam. You know, to me, being a veteran from that time, it was kind of like, well, thank goodness we're just trading cameras and stuff like that. We're not trading bullets. You know, we're doing that. But it's going to be a time to listen to the peacemakers, to people like you. And to our clergy and basically our bishop, to just listen to what they have to say, to keep reminding us of what Jesus said to do regarding your enemies. And that's going to be a long, tough road to hoe.
Well, it is. I would like to just move off of this just for a moment, but it's connected. How do we welcome all those people that are being displaced? Right now in the world, there are 80 million refugees. 80 million refugees, larger than most countries, people who have been forced to leave their homes because of drought or civil war, the lack of food and opportunity. So I had an opportunity to speak at a public high school in the diocese. They invited me to come and speak and asked me if I would talk to all the middle school to high school students. Well, I'm now 71 years of age. I woke up in the middle of the night with a panic attack. What do I have to say to children who are 60 years younger than myself? How is it that I will keep their attention for an hour? Holy smokes, I can pray about it. I can prepare for it, but what kind of reception will I receive? Well, I walk into this high school. The kids come in, they sit down. They're quiet and they're polite. They're surrounded by their teachers who care a great deal for them. The guidance counselor who has been working in the school for 25 years says that now almost one third of their student body are children who have come from Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, walked across Mexico and found their way into this country. Here are all these wonderful Hispanic children whose parents are working at Ashley Furniture and Pilgrim's Pride and milking 24/7 in the milking parlors of central Wisconsin. And I started to talk with them and I had them get up and I would go and I would ask them questions. And nobody said, I don't know. I don't care. Here are kids who have just learned English, wanting to respond, telling me what was good in their life, how grateful they are for their parents and for their families, for the school lunch program and their classmates. And here are children who have grown up in Western Wisconsin, come from strong German, Norwegian, or Irish families, welcoming in these children who have come from another world. And these children were so polite and well-behaved and engaged.
We had such a remarkable time talking with Karen Becker from Catholic Charities about her work with Afghan refugees. And one of the stories that she mentioned, I don't know whether we talked about it before or not, but she was over at wherever you can get a cold drink on Fort McCoy, taking a break. And there was a young Afghan boy, very small, who was kind of hiding behind his big sister, looking at Karen Becker. And he kept looking at her and then looking up at his sister. And finally, Karen went over and she said, am I doing something that is incorrect? I mean, what's going on? And she was being very nice about it. And the young lady who spoke very good English said, no. It's just that you have very blue eyes and very light hair, which is actually gray, but that's beside the point. She says, you don't look like any of us. He hasn't seen anyone like you before. And Karen whips out her wallet, and she has a son-in-law who I forget where he's from, but he has dark hair and a beard and dark eyes. And he's one of her in-laws. And the little boy and the girl look at this picture, and the girl goes, he looks just like us. She goes, yeah, there's lots of people who look like you here. She goes, that's so good, because I was so afraid that when we finally get into a school somewhere, we're going to be looking strange and funny to them, and maybe they won't like us. These are the fears that these people have, that they don't know. They don't know how we're going to treat them and how they're going to, whether we're going to just ostracize them because they don't look the same. You know, it's just craziness. I was just reading before we got going here tonight that the Jewish Defense League says that the number of attacks on and vandalism on Jewish institutions and individuals is up 30% from last year. That for some reason, people are just randomly, you know, spraying paint on temples and synagogues and accosting people on the street who they've never met, who's never harmed them, never done a single thing, all because of some perceived, conspiracy theory or some nonsense that is floating around. And I don't know how you, besides doing what we're talking about, how you get people to understand that what they're doing is not only wrong, it's just absolutely crazy what they're doing.
See, Jack, there's a lot of free-floating anger right now, and anger always needs a target, and you always target those people who are less likely to have to be able to defend themselves. See, the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber said there's two ways we interact with each other, I-thou or I-it. I-thou is that with reverence, I recognize that you are made in the image and likeness of God and are very good. We know what that's like to be treated with that kind of respect. I, it, we make another person into an object. It's those people. It's the other. And that's why Jesus asks, who is your neighbor? Who is your neighbor? Well, how about this Samaritan that you don't agree with, that you do not worship with? Look at how that Samaritan acted. Who is your neighbor? A person, not an object. And this is the real danger right now, is the objectification of other people, making judgments about people because of how they look or what their gender is or their economic appearance. I work a great deal with people who don't have a place to live. The number of people who don't have a place to call home is growing. Well, housing prices. And how could you build an affordable house today with materials and the cost of finding a good carpenter? It's extraordinary. It's almost impossible. So how do we find places for people to live who have difficulty, who have had hard traveling? They're not those people. They are our brothers and sisters, much like the people in Ukraine who are fleeing, our brothers and sisters, much like the people who are at the American border. Whether you like it or not, they are our brothers and sisters, made in the image and likeness of God. How do we extend that kind of courtesy and hospitality? How do we live out the gospel each and every day? These are our challenges, not with blaming or attacking, not by projecting anger and disgust onto other people, but to welcoming them as the presence of God that they are.
We had a time in San Antonio when I was working down there, and a phrase which I may have mentioned to in a previous show, but it has stuck with me, and I cannot say it in Spanish because I don't know how to say it in Spanish, but there was a saying that some of our Mexican neighbors had that was essentially, the only reason we don't love you is because we haven't met you yet. And that really warmed my heart to know about that thing. We just had 2 weeks ago or so now, the April 15th power cutoffs going on because of people who, for whatever reason, could not pay their power bills during the cold winter. And many times, you know, it was because they lost their jobs because of COVID, all the things that we know about going on. And we tried to talk more about that with Roberto Partaru, understanding that this is not something that is that you should be ashamed of. That this could happen to anybody. And a lot of people, there was more this year than last year, who through no fault of their own, just simply didn't have enough income to meet the outgo. And they went to Catholic Charities, and Catholic Charities works with them and the power companies to try to get a plan so they have their power left on. But once again, this is Catholic Charities doing this. This is them doing it. They don't care who these people are. They don't care what the situation is. They will try to get them to work with them to understand their cash flow and their budgeting and help them with those kind of things. But they don't walk in and they don't go, shame, shame, shame to you. Your power is getting cut off. They don't do that. They just go, how can we help you? And it doesn't matter whether you're Catholic. It doesn't matter anything. It just matters whether you've got the need or not. And this is the kind of stuff we keep talking about that is going on all around us to help counterbalance all of the meanness of, like you say, the free-floating anger that's out there. There's an awful lot of people just angry, all the rage going on, and people just yelling at each other constantly. Amazing, isn't it?
Well, it is. In some ways, it's self-inflicted. By paying attention to social media posts that are clearly designed to make people feel anxious or to put people at opposition with each other. I get an opportunity right now, and things are opening up again, to travel across the country. And I, everywhere I go, I'm meeting good people doing good work. I'm working with people who are working in electrical utilities who during storm surges are out there at 3 o'clock in the morning restoring power for people. I'm getting a chance to meet with people who are leaders in public education. Last week, I spoke with people who are builders in downtown Milwaukee, helping to rebuild that city. And everywhere I go, Jack, I'm meeting good people who are doing good work, people who care deeply about their families and about their communities. The group that I spoke to, the builders in Milwaukee, they had a clothing drive. People were bringing their used suits so people at a shelter could have clothes to wear to an interview. I mean, this kind of thing is happening all the time. Good people doing good work. At the Place of Grace, every Tuesday, we get a visit from the Hunger Task Force, bringing us produce and bread and dairy products that could not be sold in the stores or were overproduced so that it doesn't go to the landfill. And we give it out graciously to people who are making the choice between gas money to go to work or food for their families. People, elderly people on fixed incomes whose Social Security hasn't kept up with the cost of living. We know the price of an apartment, and we have older people coming, making the choice between medications and groceries. And what do? You do what you can with what you have, where you're at. That's the gospel. At the time that Jesus lived, not everybody was fed. At the time that Jesus lived, not everybody was healed. At the time that Jesus lived, not all divisions were healed. But Jesus did what he could with what he had, where he was at. And then he comes to the disciples after the resurrection and sends them to the ends of the earth. And guess what? These fishermen and carpenters and zealots and tax collectors, they did it. They took the good news of what they experienced, the peace of Christ, and brought it to the world.
We hopefully, his schedule is very fluid, but I should have Bishop Callahan on soon. And one of my favorite topics to talk to him about is Pentecost, because what a dramatic, fantastic celebration that is. There was a little ornament that he gave us. It's just an inexpensive little thing that has made of ceramic, and it has the dove descending. Now, I noticed on the Ukraine flag, they have a descending dove as well. I don't know if that is meant to be the Holy Spirit or it is meant to be something else, but I thought that was significant to see that on the flag of Ukraine, they have a stylized dove descending.
See, in the Eastern Rite, they have a much stronger theology of the Holy Spirit. So that Pentecost is a major holiday in the Eastern Orthodox. So we have a focus on Jesus as the second person of the Blessed Trinity, but they would have the same level of focus on the Holy Spirit, their paraclete, the paracletus. And what that literally means is the one who responds to the cry. So the understanding of the paracletus, after a child is born, they're placed on their mother's chest, and the child cries out and are comforted by the love of the mother, the paracletus. That's their understanding of the Spirit, the one who responds to the cry. And that's why you see Ukrainians, in terms of reaching out to their brothers and sisters who are suffering terribly, one who responds to the cry. There's a spiritual power here that's at work. A spiritual power that we saw in terms of the resistance of the Jewish people, of the resistance of the French resistors, of people who resisted evil by responding to the cry of the people who were in need. And that's how Europe was rebuilt. We responded to the cry. These are our brothers and sisters. We did it before, we can do it again.
And these religious leaders, I had some time ago now, we had Bishop Callahan on with the Lutheran bishop, and also the now retired rabbi from our diocese from La Crosse area. These guys, they love each other. I mean, they're like brothers working together. And I have the same basic feeling for people of religious belief, people of spiritual need, who I'm so impressed with anybody who spends time to even investigate these things. I'm a real big fan of the Holy Spirit. That Christmas ornament I got, that's not getting put away for the year. That's hung up on a shelf and is not being taken down because it's a beautiful reminder of what we're talking about, the Holy Spirit. And also, like last week, we were talking with Chris Rogers. I said, there's this thing that is in every gospel, there's always an angel or someone saying, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. This crazy thing with this Russia, and they've got a long history of it. And I'm half Polish, half Slavic. My grandfather was born practically on the Russian border in the Tatras. But there's this Slavic thing that is both suspicious of people from the outside, but also they seem to be scared of the rest of the world. And I don't understand that. I have Polish relatives who never really bonded with their community. They kept to themselves. And it was sad to see, because one by one, of course, they would pass away, and there was fewer and fewer of them left until there weren't any. They're afraid of something. I don't know what.
Well, I think that's what happens, is that when we look at each other as a stranger rather than as a fellow human being, when you recognize that once you learn somebody's life story well, it's very difficult not to like them, not to try to understand them. How many times have each of us talked with somebody that we didn't think that we liked, and then we got to understand the trauma in their lives, the things that they had suffered, the burdens that they carry, and all of a sudden we begin to see them in a new light. Isn't it interesting that this Sunday's reading is Jesus telling these fishermen how to fish? I always kind of laugh that the disciples never catch anything unless they're with a carpenter, who says, throw your nets off to the other side. And then the first person to recognize that Jesus is on the shore making shore lunch is Peter. And it says even in the gospel, he's scantily clothed. Well, he's a fisherman. He's out in the boat in the middle of the night. He's hot. He jumps in the water. He runs to the shore. And Jesus looks at him. Here is a man who he recognized had denied him three times. Three times, one of his best friends tells everybody, I don't know who you are. And then three times Jesus asked Peter, do you love me? Doesn't focus on what's taken place in the past. It's right now. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know I love you. It's about that restoration of relationships. See, what's extraordinary is that at some point in the world, we all have to live with our enemies. We all have to live with our adversaries in every community. Let's be honest. When we go and worship in our churches, we don't like everybody else in the church. They don't like us sometimes for our behavior, our quirks, but we're human beings, and so we have the ability as brothers and sisters to love each other, to be concerned about each other's welfare, to treat each other with dignity and respect. This is the challenge of the gospel for our times, not to see others as objects, but as fellow human beings, brothers and sisters, made in the image and likeness of God.
And what you're saying is directly from some of the many things that Jesus said in the New Testament. I mean, if people actually just look at the things you said, like in one of those red letter Bibles, he spells it out for you. And it doesn't mean it's easy. It certainly isn't. I mean, I can understand that myself. But he's telling you how to behave, and it makes perfect sense, and it all fits together, which is the good part. So it is echoed in all these things you do with servant leadership and all these different things that that basically make up a good part of goodness. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. I want to ask you a couple of questions in our last 10 minutes or so as to what servant leadership is and also how it is taught at Viterbo. I'm just curious about that. So let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. A lot of serious talk this particular hour with Tom Thibodeau about, among many other things, but the plight of people in Ukraine and how this is influencing the entire world. Many, many religious institutions are, at this time of year, and frankly, any time of year, looking for donations because they've got to keep upkeep going or else things don't work. And it's pretty obvious with the two-year COVID lockdown thing that not as many people are either attending services, they're coming back now, but for a long time they weren't, or because of financial conditions, they have not been able to really physically donate money to help out. It's an understandable reality. But you will notice that while the Diocese of La Crosse still has a bishop's annual appeal, because we need to operate too, we're dealing with the same financial stresses that everybody else is, at the top of the Diocese of La Crosse website is an appeal for Ukraine. In other words, they're saying, we need the money for the Diocese of La Crosse, but there is desperate need for medical supplies, clothing, and food for Ukraine. We've been mentioning in previous weeks how the Ukrainian Catholic Church in Milwaukee is doing exactly the same thing. So it is an act of charity on the part of these religious institutions to, in addition to asking you for funds to help keep them going, and there's a lot of good things that need help. They're also saying, we also understand that if you give some of it to the help for Ukraine, you're still doing the work of the church. There is that saying that by their fruits ye shall know them. And I have great respect for all of these religious institutions who, even though they need money themselves, are putting that need aside for the greater need of those who are suffering terribly in Ukraine. For more information, just go to diolc.org and take a look at what is right at the top of the diocesan website page. Talking with Tom Thibodeau about a wide-ranging number of topics, including the what's going on these days and how it tends to stretch your charity a little bit and maybe make you feel a little bit grouchy and maybe make you feel really angry, but how maybe that isn't the best solution in the world. We mentioned that you're the Distinguished Professor of Servant Leadership at Viterbo University. Can you explain first, A, in 10 minutes or less, right? This is like another two-hour lecture talk we should be having. What is servant leadership and how is it taught at Viterbo?
All right. A definition that we use at Viterbo that we developed over 20 years, we have the only master's degree of servant leadership in the country up until a couple of years ago, the only master's degree of servant leadership in the world. We established it back in the year 2000. And we say servant leadership is the ability to inspire and engage others to work for a greater good every day, to inspire and engage others to work for a greater good every day. And in the business world, Jack, I'm not talking theologians. I'm not talking people that are nonprofits. In the business world, people will say very clearly that the greatest servant leader of all time is Jesus. There's nobody even in second place. If the ability to inspire and engage others to work for a greater good, well, that's, and that where does it take place? Well, on Holy Thursday, the washing of the feet. What I have done for you, you are to do for each other. We are to serve each other in this way. As I mentioned earlier, if service is beneath us, leadership is beyond us. And one of the key phrases that I repeat in every presentation I give, service is love made visible. Service is love made visible. In all of our lives are predicated on the service of other people. Other people who sacrifice on our behalf. Think of the farmers who right now are out in their barns, finishing up their milking, having no idea what their milk prices are going to be next week, but making sure that the world is fed. Service is love made visible. Think about it for just a moment. 100,000 American soldiers are on the borders in the Eastern Bloc countries, making sure that the war does not spread. 100,000 soldiers, that means 100,000 families have deployed brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, to protect this nation, to serve us. Think about the number of people who commit their lives to service today as volunteer firefighters and EMTs who go out in the middle of the night and respond to a call because a neighbor has been in a terrible accident. Think of the number of people who work all night long at a long-term care facility, making sure that our beloved elders are not left alone to care for themselves. Service is love made visible. And we teach this over and over again. Dr. Martin Luther King said, everybody can be great because everybody can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and your verb agree to serve. You don't have to know the second theory of thermodynamics and physics to serve. You only need a heart full of grace and a soul generated by love. A heart full of grace and a soul generated by love. Which of us isn't capable of that? And wherever I go and speak in the country, I talk to people about this, and people choose to be servant leaders. People choose to serve. They choose to build up the lives and workplaces for other people. Think about business people who pay a fair wage, provide benefits so people are able to have health care. Think of our businesses, like in your own small town, Jack, where people pay tax dollars that support roads and firefighters and teachers. Think about the importance of it is to have a good paying job where you're treated with dignity and respect. So servant leaders can be found everywhere. And so far in 20 years, we have graduated over 300 people who are serving throughout the country and throughout the world. Let me tell you one story. This is a story of resurrection and hope. And I think we need stories of hope. Father John LaSuba is there as a pastor in Byron, Minnesota, just right outside of Rochester. And John LaSuba came to a conference on servant leadership that we had. And here I see this tall African, 6'6", 6'7", who has a hat on his head, says, I love muskie. And here's this wonderful black man, and I get a chance to meet him, and he tells me he's a priest working in Rochester, Minnesota. He wants to take a course in servant leadership because a deacon in his church was in our program. And so whenever he could afford it, one course a semester he would take. And he had this marvelous sense of humor. I can remember when South Sudan became a new country, the newest country in the world, and he was just jubilant because he is from Southern Sudan. When he was 12, the Islamic government from the north came down and took out his father and his three brothers into the street. And because they were Catholic, they killed him. And his mother runs out into the street and puts her arms around her son and says, save me one. John learned his numbers and his letters in the sand under a tree. At one point, they move into a larger city, and he goes to a Catholic school, and he sees a priest wearing a cassock. And he says to the priest, where do you get clothes like that? And the priest says, you have to become a priest. He said, not really a great idea for becoming a priest, but I became a priest because I wanted a cassock. And after he got ordained as a priest, he went out and started saying mass for people in Southern Sudan. There was a price on his head because of the Islamic government in the north that gave us Darfur. For 7 years, he said mass for about 53 different congregations in the jungle, under the trees. And one night, his driver was assassinated, and the people said, Father John, they're coming after you. He had to flee Southern Sudan and goes to Uganda, where he's in a refugee camp, where he is found by Catholic Relief Services, who brings him to this country. While he's in New Jersey at a center, he meets a priest from the Winona Diocese who says, we have a number of Somali and Sudanese that are coming to Rochester. Would you come and serve with us? And he said, yes. And Bishop Harrington brought him to Rochester. And he's beginning his master's in servant leadership. And for his master's thesis, he wanted to build a Catholic grade school in Southern Sudan, the newest country in Africa, so that children would be taught servant leadership because all the country had known were dictatorships. And with his help of his parish and the people of Rochester, he raised $500,000 and built a school for 350 children, St. John the Evangelist Catholic School in Southern Sudan. It operated for 2 years. Civil war broke out, and the children are now in refugee camps in Uganda. And yet the board of directors in Rochester pays tuition for the headmaster to make sure that the children get into school in Uganda, and yet they will come back to their school. And I asked Father John, what do you think? Will you get this school built? And he said, if not in my lifetime, then in eternity. When we are raised, we are asked the question, why did God make you? God made me to know, love, and serve God in this world and the next. There is hope that goes beyond what we can see. Jesus proclaimed a point at which we might never arrive. The kingdom of God is here. It is so immense we cannot understand it, but when we brush up against it, it knocks our socks off. This was what gives us all hope. Let us not give up on hope. In the midst of darkness, we are called to be the light of Christ.
Good words to end this particular session. Yeah, got to keep praying for our enemies and keep praying for those who are suffering right now. And you can't separate it out. I keep thinking that in some alternate universe, some alternate dimension, had the leader of Russia simply gone to Ukraine and said, what can we do for each other to be mutually beneficial, be a different world? And maybe some cooler heads will do that. It's going to be extremely difficult for the one side, the Russians particularly, to say, we want to make up for this. We don't know whether we ever can, but can you forgive us? That would be a test. But it happened in Rwanda. We've had forgiveness in Rwanda. We've had forgiveness in South Africa. We've had places where forgiveness, you know, it's hard. It'd be really hard, but we'll have to wait and see what happens. But gee whiz, a lot of good stuff. Again, your main point is that keep trying to think about the good stuff going on and don't dwell on the bad, because there's plenty of that out there. And half of it is just designed to get more clicks on your website or something like that. So that's good.
Blessed are the peacemakers. The kingdom of God is yours.
And that is true. That is very true. And I'm looking forward to Pentecost to talk to the bishop more about that. And the Holy Spirit, boy, I'll tell you, wonderful thing. You could spend a lot of time just contemplating the Holy Spirit, and you could do a lot worse. Tom Thibodeau is the Distinguished Professor of Servant Leadership at Viterbo University. You can also find some of his TED Talks on YouTube and other things as well. I'm sure there are links to a lot of your things up on Viterbo's own website. And if you want to hear more about his things, he's there. Are you still on the radio?
Yeah, still have a WDRT, Community of Goodness.
And when
and
are
then
you
I do podcasts for professional dairy producers of Wisconsin. I'm heard in barns across the country because people considered me to be a moving speaker. I know that's terrible, but I thought I'd leave with a poor joke.
There you go. Just Google Tom Thibodeau and Viterbo, and you will get the right one. And you can get links to all the different places that he can be heard. Tom, thank you so much for being here. Good to see you, even though it's via our laptops. But, you know, we'll get together one of these days. We'll get together.
Yes, we will, Jack. And, it's always a privilege to have an opportunity to sit down and have a conversation with you and with the people in our friends in the diocese.
Well, I always feel happy and uplifted after I hear you. And I'm hoping our listeners are having the same experience. I'm quite certain that they are. Tom, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Jack. Good night.
Good night now. Jack Zosia here with you in the last minute or two of Connecting the Diocese. Kind of got the wind knocked out of me. We're talking so much about how nice it was to see the family for the first time in 2 years, and the phone rang in the last 2 minutes of the show here, and it was the son of my sister-in-law to tell me that his mother had died. We have not been able to see her because of COVID down in Ames, Iowa for the past 2 years. Lucy also was an only child like me, and both of us relish being in this large and very diverse family. And the one good thing I can say is that this is a family of faith. And because of that, unlike some of the folks we talked about with Tom Thibodeau, they're not saying, where is God? We know where God is. And now we know where Lucy is as well. No need for me to get out my music appreciation album from Handel's Messiah. The words are burned into my brain from when my own mother died. The trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised, and you will be raised incorruptible. So I will see you next week. God bless you too, and I'll catch you again next week on Connecting the Diocese.